Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
If you want to get a sense of how massive the federal investigation into January 6th is, here's something to keep in mind. The FBI, they are still arresting rioters more than 2 years later. These are people they've known about for months. People like Daniel and Peyton Valdez, who just got charged in the last few days. Daniel's Peyton's dad. They traveled to D.C. from Colorado. Daniel took pictures of his son inside the Capitol. In one snapshot, Peyton is holding up a riot shield that's been dropped on the floor. He's cracked open a beer. There's even this one video of Peyton online telling the camera, the next time we come back, it ain't gonna be effing unarmed. That's for goddamn sure. Afterwards, he texted a few friends. And it looks like they said, like, oh, looks like we're gonna be arrested.
Yes. There's a lot of comments like that. Yep. And then you eventually will. But like, that's the weird thing where I think a lot of people probably, it must be really unsettling if you went into the Capitol and you don't know when this knock on your door is going to come.
If it surprises you that the FBI is still hauling people like this in front of judges years later, Ryan Riley, who's a justice reporter over at NBC News, he says it really shouldn't. How often are they tracking people down still now?
Still very regularly. They're only really a third through the number of people who totally could be arrested. So, yeah, I mean, they're definitely still coming in. But based on the current trajectory, they're never going to get to everybody who they could arrest, even though.
Never.
No.
Even though, like, they know their identities and everything.
They have more than 1,000 identities of people who haven't been arrested yet.
Even more fascinating to Ryan is how a whole lot of these suspects got identified in the first place. Of the people who are identifiable who were at the Capitol on January 6th, how many of them have been identified by online sleuths?
Hundreds.
These online sleuths, they call themselves sedition hunters. And Ryan says they've been the driving force behind the federal investigation into the Capitol riot. So today on the show, we'll go inside their world. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
So, Ryan, where were you on January 6th? Like, how were you watching what played out?
I was at home, like a lot of people. I think I would have probably been there had it not been for the pandemic, but it was something I was reporting on the Proud Boys in the lead up to, because Enrique Tarrio had been arrested the prior day. And we were all sort of aware that a bunch of people who believed a crazy conspiracy theory were coming to D.C.
I remember that day just sitting there watching TV, kind of bowled over by everything I was able to witness myself, even though I wasn't there. I'm kind of curious if you had the same moment. Like, I was just like, this is crazy. I'm watching people scale the Capitol.
Yeah, and I did. And there was also a huge divide, I think, between what we were seeing online and what we were seeing on our television screens.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, in terms of the cable news coverage, what you had was often these sort of distant images, right? Because there was not a lot of coverage of the west side of the Capitol, which is where most of the violence took place. Most of the cameras were on the east side of the Capitol. And so we saw these images come through, and even looking back at the coverage of it that day, and it's often like, oh, there are some people on the stairs. This is kind of crazy. But we really didn't have that view of just this violent mob that was assaulting law enforcement officers on the west side of the Capitol. Stack up what was on television with what was happening on the internet. And I think that divide sort of became clear, because even, you know, the FBI wasn't even aware of what was happening. You weren't in the middle of the action in a way that a lot of these videos that we saw online and live streams were.
As these raw images came out, what struck you? And I wonder, like, when did you begin to think, these images could be used to identify these people?
Early on, I think there were a lot of people who went very viral, sort of the low-hanging fruit of this investigation, who were arrested very quickly, sort of the
people who looked silly or were very violent.
Correct. Exactly. We saw that with QAnon Shaman, obviously, was arrested within days. Big O, the guy who put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk, also same sort of situation, arrested very quickly. And because it had so much media attention, these were, you know, people who knew them were identifying them and sending them into the FBI, or they were just openly bragging about it under their own names online. And it wasn't that difficult to find them. And I think what happened very quickly is some of the open source researchers who have been through this in previous iterations, recognized the importance of scouring and collecting that information pretty quickly.
How did you first see people online begin to gather images and then sort of methodically figure out who someone was?
So the way I sort of came into this was because there was this video of this woman known as Bullhorn Lady. She was actually just sentenced last week, spoiler alert, to more than 4 years in federal prison. But this was this woman named Rachel Powell. And I sort of made a joke tweet because it reminded me of the voice that she was using as she was on this bullhorn and instructing members of the mob how they could take the building. She said,
"There's also two doors in the other room. One at the rear and one to the right when you go in. So people should probably coordinate together if you're going to take this building."
It sort of reminded me almost as like that, you know, frustrated tone that you have with your kids, and almost like she was chaperoning the insurrection.
Like she was a PTA mom.
I actually made that exact joke. I said, you know, $20 says that this results not only in criminal charges, but also in a PTA resignation. and shortly thereafter, someone landed in my inbox and said, "Hey, Ryan, we've identified this person. We're trying to figure out what to do with it." Ultimately, I got a little bit scooped there because The New Yorker and Ronan Farrow ended up writing that story. But, you know, I sort of put my journalistic jealousy aside and stuck with it and got the next one that they had identified and were having trouble getting any action on. And that was a much more serious crime. It was the individual who drove a stun gun into Officer Mike Fanone's neck on January 6th. And this was someone who was at a bunch of Trump rallies in California. And so ultimately, it was a month after we broke the story revealing his name that he had his back door busted down by the FBI. And he's been in federal custody ever since and was recently sentenced to 12 and a half years in federal prison.
Those first tips Ryan got came from a guy named Forrest Rogers, who's still one of the only sleuths who's gone public with his real name. But Ryan soon realized that Forrest was part of a growing network of investigators. This group took pains to conceal their identities, so they wouldn't meet up in Zoom calls, for instance, That could make their IP addresses and other information way too public. Instead, they kept in touch on encrypted apps, getting to know each other exclusively from anonymized usernames and cartoon avatars.
As this went on, what's been interesting about it is there are still a lot of these sleuths who I do not know their real identity. But what I do know is I know their track records.
Really? Even after like years of reporting on them?
There are some people who I've met in person who I do not know their real names. One of them has met my wife, who I don't actually know their real name. But what I do know is their investigative track record.
What a strange deep throat situation.
It is very strange. But what's interesting for me and I think for the Bureau is that they can vet all of this on their own. You don't necessarily have to just completely put yourself in someone else's hands because
they come with receipts.
They come with receipts. Precisely. Yeah. So over the years, I've gotten to know these people and they're one people that I really, really trust.
Did they know each other before January 6th? And like January 6th just sort of kicked people into gear, or did January 6th bring people together?
Oh, no, not at all. That brought everyone together. Yeah, these are people from all across the country who never knew each other, but now, you know, some of them were best friends, right? And like send each other Christmas cards.
It's one thing to form an online community, but actually performing this investigative digital forensic work, making positive identifications from hours and hours of footage, these sleuths needed tools. So one guy actually created an app that combed through hours of archived footage to find fleeting, unguarded moments when suspects were especially identifiable. It leveraged a technology that has snuck into the background of everyday life.
Facial recognition. So you can get part of it and that connects them with another person in this sort of database that they have altogether of all these videos. So it might have only a partial face shot, but that'll connect them with that other part of their face. So, you know, if you have someone with sunglasses, it will connect them to someone without sunglasses who is the same person, right? So you can get them at various points. I think a good example I could talk about the Logan Barnhart case. Essentially what happened is you had an individual who dragged a cop down the stairs, but he had sunglasses on, his face was often covered. And then he also, you know, threw a pole later. He was involved in some of the real violence of January 6th, but he was always covered up and you couldn't quite get a good face shot. Then when they ran that facial recognition check, it pulls up all of these romance novel covers. It turns out this guy was a bodybuilder. And so that from there, they then went on his Instagram profile, found him wearing the same sweatshirt. He was, you know, recorded a video of himself in the gym punching a punching bag. And also he had posted about January 6th saying, "You guys don't know what really happened." And I think he was sort of mocking the FBI. They identified him that way, sent that into the FBI. And then when I ended up talking to the FBI, they had an arrest sort of going in place.
It just makes you realize how public we all are now, even if we don't think we are.
Yes, but they don't just send in these things after getting a facial recognition match. Even though facial recognition is improving and getting better, they really do find some other confirming material that they can use to make sure that the people that they are saying is a person, is actually the person.
You know, online sleuthing has this mixed history. Like back with the Boston Marathon bombing, crowdsourced investigations eventually led to a man being wrongly accused. What do you think made this investigation different?
I think they learned a lot of the lessons of the Boston Marathon bombing. And very quickly, when you had people throwing out IDs, they would very quickly get replies. They would get direct messages about not doing that. And the rules were pretty well established and spread from the early days. We do not name people online. So while there may sort of be these independent people freelance, they were pretty quickly rejected, I think, from the overall sedition hunters community if they went about naming people.
Were there any IDs that went wrong? Like, how did the sleuths handle that?
Very early on, I think when people who weren't actually involved with the effort or were sort of pushed out of the effort might have wrongly identified people. I remember I've got a few tips, random tips that were not correct. There was someone who was featured on the FBI's list that someone thought was this mayor from California or something, and they vaguely looked the same. I can see why someone thought that, but all I had to do was go back and say, "Oh no, there was like a council meeting or something that day that he was there for." So I was able to vet that pretty easily. But
it sounds like you kind of became a sleuth too.
In the early days, I mean, there was a lot of interest in who these people were, and it was clear the FBI was overwhelmed. And I think that that's really when the SLUs ended up turning more to reporters and to the media, because they were not getting anywhere. And the feedback loop was really concerning, because the FBI has these pretty stringent, strict rules about talking about ongoing investigations. And that has been a source of frustration for the SLUs, because they can't find out updates in these cases. They'll be like, I sent this to you 2 years ago. What the hell has been happening? Where does this stand? Where is this at?
After the break, this frustration with the FBI, it turns out it was indicative of a much deeper, more bureaucratic problem.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
One thing that stands out from your reporting is just how much faster this big group of random, untrained people were able to investigate what happened on January 6th compared to the federal government. I wonder if we can just talk about that a bit. Like, one of the things you make a point of in your book is to say that, like, the FBI was founded at the turn of the century in 1908 same year the Model T came out. So more people have cars, more people can do all sorts of interstate crimes because they can get there. So there's a need for a federal Bureau of Investigation. It seems like we're at a similar technological turning point now with the internet, but it doesn't seem like the FBI is turning.
They're not. And I mean, it's tough to turn a huge ship like the FBI. It has its ways that they've been doing for decades, generations, and it's very difficult to get them to pivot. And I think if you just think about the people who join the FBI and the people that you really need to work at the FBI in terms of the technological resources, this becomes sort of crystal clear. Because if you're really technologically skilled and you spent, you know, a good amount of money on a degree, and then you're looking at your options, and okay, it's on the one hand, I could give up pot for a year before I apply, and I could basically set a limit on where I could ever get financially in terms of salary. The FBI doesn't have really cool campuses in cities where people want to live. If you're a special agent, they could dispatch you anywhere in the country, and they don't really care what your spouse's career is. So it's not particularly appealing to young people who are technologically skilled to join an organization like the FBI and then deal with all of these sort of bureaucratic hurdles that you see them really dealing with.
One thing I don't get from your reporting, like you talk about how the people working together, they created an app, they found ways to, like, you know, plug video into things. I mean, why can't the FBI just download the app? Like, what? I don't understand why they're so stuck.
I think there are some concerns there, especially with the FBI just grabbing things online or anything in public. There are some First Amendment concerns. The FBI shouldn't just be, like, grabbing anything on a protest. And that's how some of these IDs come about. Often there's some sort of separate event. A lot of the Stop the Steal rallies were huge for the SLUs, because you'll have an instance where someone shows up to the Capitol and then you get a facial recognition match with a photo of them in, say, Harrisburg. I say Harrisburg because that's where a lot of individuals were gathered who ended up storming the Capitol at one of these Stop the Steal protests. In fact, one of them was standing behind Jim Jordan and then went on to, while in military gear, tell other rioters to steal cops' guns and pepper spray a line of officers.
So you're saying the problem is that it looks like political persecution.
Right. And I think they're super sensitive to that, especially when you have all these members of Congress who are more really turning up the heat, I think, on the FBI.
I mean, that's a real problem, given that there is one political party in this country that is encouraging political violence.
It is. It is. It's concerning. And I think that they're all sort of watching where this goes. But, you know, you can only placate so much. And I think that that's the real situation. The crystallizing moment for me was when there's this FBI individual at the Washington field office who was being interviewed about what was happening in the lead up to January 6th. And she sort of begrudgingly said that, yes, you know, rhetoric was getting more heated as it got closer to January 6th. And then there's a pause and they sort of asked the next question. And she says, on both sides. And that was just like a gobsmacking moment for me, because it's like, what are you talking about? There were not Joe Biden supporters plotting to storm the Capitol to overthrow the election that he won. Like, it fundamentally doesn't compute.
But they felt that pressure.
It was almost like this instinctual thing that was built into them, because we don't want to look politically biased. And, like, you just have to talk real and be like, the right wing threat has been so clear for so long. And I think that that's what the fundamental disconnect is here.
When did it become clear to the FBI that with the January 6th case, they would need to accept outside help from these internet sleuths?
I mean, it's sort of, I think, morphed in the first year, because early on, it was mostly people who knew people that the tips that they were coming in online. And there was an overwhelming number of tips they had to deal with. I do not envy them for having to sort through 200,000 plus tips that they received about January 6th. That's overwhelming. I mean, there are just cases probably sitting there today that they have never gotten around to. And it'll probably only be when the SLUs sort of give them a little bit of a kick in the pants on something, or say, hey, we found this person doing something, that they'll go back and follow up on some of those tips or use those tips in some way. But it took a while for this trust to sort of build up, I think, between the SLUs and the FBI. And I think that the SLUs have learned a lot about the FBI and sort of been shocked by how far behind they are. And and just to what was happening online, or making sure that it's brought to their attention. Because you just don't have people who are going out and like, oh yeah, let me search this hashtag, see what's out there on the internet. It's more of like a closed off system that they're sort of dealing with. And that's not that great when you consider they're only dealing with this very limited knowledge. You know, if I were building one of these cases, it would be very tough for me to find all of this evidence and sort of compile it together in the way that the SLUs had if I was just going off of a tip and I can only do this on my own. And I think the collaboration has really been one of the SLUs' secret weapons here, is just being able to talk very freely, openly, and in these sort of chat forums very quickly.
With each other.
That hive mind and that crowdsourcing is so beneficial. That's when I have some of my best story ideas, is when you're just talking with someone and then someone adds, and then you're like, oh, this is a story. And that's what they really thrive on, I think, is this community that they formed. And with the FBI, it's just a whole different structure. They have these field offices and these fiefdoms, really, where there are all these different interests, but you can't really have an open and honest conversation or a free conversation with them because all this is being documented forever. So unless you dial them up on the phone, and that's not really how this collaboration works. And I think about doing this via email, and it seems just like, it seems like such a chore. It really seems mind-sucking. Whereas if you're dealing with one of these chat platforms and sort of a more constant communication is just a really big element of this. And I think that that's what the SLUs have gotten to know over these years.
2.5 years in, it's hard for the sedition hunters themselves to measure their success. Sleuths do not know exactly how many arrests have helped facilitate. They just know they've been in touch with the FBI about hundreds of cases. There are 2 more years for the feds to continue to arrest rioters. So these online investigators, they're still on the case.
Do you think the SLUs will ever come forward and claim public credit with their full names? Do you think in 20 years, one of these folks will be sitting around with their grandkids like, Sonny, I did that, you know?
It depends, really, frankly, where things go. I mean, if we're in a second Trump administration, I think there's going to be a lot of very worried SLUs. Obviously, these cases are probably just all going to go away instantly. But, you know, if we get through 2024 and there's relative calm and maybe we get past the statute of limitations and these cases have sort of all gone away, I could see some of them maybe be willing to be more public facing. But I think this is more of a thing that they'll be able to point to and tell people about. But I don't know if they're going to be wanting to be that publicly out there. It really depends on the threat environment, because obviously there's a huge interest in identifying a lot of the people who are working behind the scenes here, and they've been a major target for people on the right. So I think that there's, you know, a lot of concerns just like safety wise and what that means for the rest of your life to have that associated with you on the internet.
Ryan, I am super grateful for your time and your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ryan Riley is a justice reporter at NBC News, and he's the author of Sedition Hunters: How January 6th Broke the Justice System. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I will catch you back here next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.